Monster Man, special episode, Spider, Giant. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters, and specifically Patreon supporter Jake Baker. If you'd like to be like Jake and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go on down to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to your own special episode, you'll also receive the occasional bonus content that goes to all my patrons, plus my other show, Patron Deities, which is all about the Deities and Demigods book, and using religion and mythology in your fantasy RPGs generally. This is also the inaugural special episode of the Monster Man Holiday Boss Rush. That is to say, I am trying to crank out the last of my patron specials as fast as I can without sacrificing quality. It just means I'm taking some time off of other projects to do these, and hopefully you're going to enjoy them. So Jake, thank you very much for your support of Monster Man. It really means a lot to me, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. I was talking the other day to listener and correspondent Goblin's Henchman, and I mentioned that doing the Giant Spider episode was a real challenge for me. And the reason for that is because giant spiders are great. They're already terrific. You don't need me to tell you a bunch of interesting and creative ways to use giant spiders in your fantasy RPGs. Like, they're the easiest things in the world. So I'm going to go back over why, because I think that is instructive in terms of what adapts well into being a monster. And then at the end, we'll see if maybe we can't put a little bit of a twist on them for jaded gamers. So the spider, giant is one of the classic fantasy monsters. And this makes sense, because many people are frightened of spiders. I'm not an expert on psychology, but there does seem to be some relatively prevalent human fear of spiders that is quite out of proportion to how dangerous a spider actually is to you, right? Certainly, when I was younger, I was absolutely terrified of spiders. And I did live in a part of the world where there were maybe one or two dangerous spider species, but I don't believe that I ever saw any of them. I just didn't like them. I didn't like the way they moved. I didn't like the way they acted. I didn't like the tickly feeling if one were to run over you. I hated them. And then I just kind of, you know, they don't bother me these days. Like, if one were to crawl right over me, it would startle me. But it's still a widespread human fear. It's a bit like the fear of snakes. There's just something about them that seems to set quite a lot of people off and to be prevalent in a way that's out of proportion to how dangerous they are. So that's step one sorted already. It makes sense, I guess, that people could be frightened of spiders. Some are dangerous, they're poisonous, and they're dangerous in a way that doesn't match up with how small they are. So that must be quite frightening if you are, you know, from a culture that doesn't have a very good, you know, grip on the science of poisoning. If you're in a prehistoric or historical society, you know, this tiny little spider bit a great big person, but yet they got sick. Why could that be? And they exhibit unusual behavior, right? They're not like other bugs. They build, some of them build webs, or they, you know, they make little trapdoors. There are things that spiders do that are strange, and they have eight legs, and they look kind of armored, and they're weird. And it's interesting that myths tend to feature spiders as intelligent and sort of technical, like the myth of Arachne, or tricky and clever, like the myths of Anansi. Now, when you take an ordinary insect or other animal monster and you scale it up to giant size, you are changing how people interact with it in a way that sometimes removes the terror of it, right? The scorpion, giant is not really all that much more frightening than a regular scorpion, or at least it's frightening in a different way. I mean, it's frightening because it's big and it could get you with its claws or whatever. But the special terror of a scorpion, which is the sting, is actually kind of reduced when it becomes giant. Because what you're afraid of with a scorpion is that you're going to put your foot in your boot and a scorpion is going to sting you, or it's going to scuttle out from under a rock and sting you. If it's the size of a car and you can see it coming, kind of takes some of the terror out of it. Or replaces it with a different kind of terror, the terror of fighting a big monster, which is frightening but not horrifying, if that makes sense. But one of the reasons that the spider, giant is such an effective monster is that its method of predation scales. So you have probably seen a spider wrapping up in its web some bug that it's caught and then injecting it with a poison with its pedipalps. And if a spider became a spider, giant, then it might be big enough to do that to you and that is a very terrifying idea. So the spider comet giant is one of those creatures that becomes more horrifying as it gets larger, because now it can do the gruesome and sort of sadistic thing that it does to smaller creatures, and it can do it to you. And this is an important principle to think about when trying to introduce a giant animal in a fantasy game. Does being giant introduce new possibilities for the things that are dangerous or interesting about this animal? Weirdly, the beaver comet giant ticks that box, because now the dam is big enough that you can go in and walk around in it. I mentioned some spiders from folklore and mythology. There are also, like, the closest thing to a D&D type giant spider seems to be a creature called the Tsuchigumo in Japanese folklore. And this is, interestingly, like, it means something like ground dwellers, so it refers both to sort of burrowing spiders, but it can also mean people, like kind of vagabonds or ruffians or particular communities that the speaker wants to disparage. So it's not always clear in some of the sources I was reading whether we're talking about Tsuchigumo like spiders or whether we're talking about Tsuchigumo people that the writer disapproves of. Another feature in support of the spider comet giant is that spiders can, in real life, get pretty big. There are some that are like a foot across. That's the, well, of the legs. That's 30 centimeters to my metric listeners. And that is pretty big. Probably the classic giant spiders of fantasy literature, of course, are the great spiders in The Hobbit and Shelob in The Lord of the Rings. And I think it's particularly interesting in the case of Shelob that there's this idea of evil in the portrayal of Shelob. In the great spiders in The Hobbit, they're dangerous, but there's also kind of like, there's also this aspect of playfulness. I mean, that's in terms of how Bilbo relates to them. And that, I guess, is, you know, it's the difference between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings in a nutshell, I suppose. But there's something unclean about Shelob. And I guess, is Ungoliant the thing that I'm thinking of in The Silmarillion? Is that right? The giant spider? Ungol just means spider. But the suggestion that there's something foul, something evil and kind of treacherous about Shelob. And of course, Shelob is intelligent, which is something that you can see in some of these spider stories as well, right? Shelob is capable of communicating and coordinating. And I presume that those will have contributed to the appearance of the spider comet giant in Dungeons & Dragons. Another reason that the giant spider is so versatile is that it can appear in a wide variety of different environments. So, for example, if you're in the woods, like in The Hobbit, well, absolutely, there could be giant spiders in the woods. You can think of them scurrying up and down the trees, you know, lowering from a branch over your head, maybe hiding in all the leaf litter. That all makes perfect sense. Spiders absolutely live in the woods. If you're in a desert, there could be spiders napping in the shade under a rock or burying themselves in sand or scuttling along the walls of desert caves, because obviously spiders do in fact live in the desert. And if you're in a ruin or a dungeon, there could completely be spiders, because we all know that spiders like to live in dark underground spaces like your basement. If when you were a kid you grew up in a house that had like a basement or a garage or a garden shed or somewhere like that, if you were like me, you were scared of going in there because of all the spiders. Actually weren't all that many spiders in my garage, which was fine, but there were certainly places when I was a kid that I did not like to go in because what if a spider crawled on me? That was really frightening to me. So many different environments that you might have an adventure in are all places that it makes sense that there could be spiders. That, like, it seems natural. So that's from, like, a setting standpoint. Then, from a tactical standpoint, giant spiders are also great because they add three-dimensionality to a combat, because they can scuttle up walls, they can make a lair in a pit, they can, you know, come down from the ceiling on a thread of their webbing. They're terrific. You know, you can have a fight in like a big vaulted dome with all kinds of balconies and things, and there's spider webs going between them, and the spiders are running along the webs and coming down from the walls. Terrific. Anything that makes you add more three-dimensionality to your game is valuable. And giant spiders are a really good way of doing that. And you can use them at low levels without harming your conscience too much. Oh, and you know what else? The giant spider's tendency to leave its victims wrapped up for later consumption gives you a way to add kind of ticking clock tension. It's also a good way to introduce NPCs. And of course, giant spiders are creatures that don't care about treasure, so it's very possible that there's some desiccated husk wrapped up in the spider's webs, but he's still got his, you know, boots of striding and springing or something on him, although should have stirred and sprung a bit better and got out of the spider's way, but you know what I mean, that you can go through his pockets and things, but you have to cut him loose from the spider's web. Or if you want to introduce a new PC to the party, you can have some juicy wriggler webbed up and just waiting for the PCs to rescue them. And all of these add memorable elements. So you're going to feel much better about that short bow plus one if it's the short bow plus one that you found in the spider's web. It could be the tiniest thing, but it just gives the item a little history that kind of leaves you with a little shudder every time you think about it. So, okay, that's great. But it's great. The giant spider's a real winner. How do we improve on this? Well, I don't think we do, but here are a couple of things that you can do to incorporate Spider's Comet Giant more effectively into a Dungeons & Dragons game. Or not more effectively, but even just like a little bit of extra pizzazz, I guess. A little bit of the old razzle-dazzle. First, you can spider up the terrain. So one thing that spiders do that makes them really interesting is that they alter the terrain that they live in. So, you know, they take a place, but then they start to spin spider webs in it. So you might wind up with the PCs finding that the only way to get across a chasm or something like that, or maybe to get through a huge cavern overhead unnoticed by the orcs below, is to take the spider webs, kill the spider and take the spider webs. But of course, spiders can sense the vibrations of movement in their webs, so that then they might come rushing to the attack. So maybe you have to figure out some way to create a diversion by, you know, twanging the webs at other points along the line while the thief darts across the sticky spider web to get to the other side of the room, right? Egg sacs make another great interactable piece of terrain, or like the big, you know, sometimes spiders will like, they'll lay eggs and then they'll web them to whatever. And that means they can be on any kind of surface. And if you hit them, of course, lots of like malformed baby spiders might pour out. And we can assume that the baby spiders of a giant spider are just the size of like regular spiders or even quite big spiders, so they'd be very frightening. Terrific. Next, you can add some kind of horror elements. One traditional way to introduce some horror mood into a scenario is to have people behaving in ways that contravene human norms of behavior. So, for example, as I said, many, many people are frightened of spiders. So, is it Ator the Fighting Eagle, the cheesy Conan knockoff? I believe the preferred term is Fonan, where the villain has like tarantulas crawling all over him. The point is that because so many people are repulsed by spiders, a person who was seemingly acting ordinary but just let spiders crawl all over them would be deeply creepy. Or if you walked into a seemingly normal house but there were just spiders walking about on every surface, you know, spiders on the piano, spiders on the rug in the hall, spiders in the vase of flowers, that's creepy. So you can add a little horror just by putting spiders into situations where they don't belong. You know, the count opens up a little enamel box to offer you a bonbon, but it's just full of spiders. Another thing to do, of course, is to have the kind of Shelob situation and give the spider a malign intelligence. Very hard to imagine that it would have a benevolent intelligence, right? But add some kind of human elements. Maybe we're talking about a were-spider, maybe we're talking about a human who can telepathically communicate with the spiders, or maybe we're just talking about a giant spider that's intelligent and can talk. It's very interesting to imagine what that creature's mindset would be like. I think most of us have come to the conclusion that it would be super malevolent, but actually, of course, there's nothing wrong with spiders in real life. Spiders are friendly creatures. They keep mosquitoes out of our houses, and if you don't want them in your room, you should just put them outside. There's your friend to animals public service announcement for today. But my point is simply that you can give that spider an intelligence and a personality, and it can be really creepy. The more you want your spiders to be not evil, the less you want them to talk and think, right? So a non-evil spider just wants to eat you because it eats things. That's what it does to the spider. It's not evil. It's just a predator. But an evil spider, they can communicate with you and be like, yes, I've wrapped you up now because I don't feel very hungry. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back tomorrow and I'm going to bite you. And then it'll liquefy your insides. You know, a spider that has some kind of ambition, like it's tired of the Gripply village taking all the giant dragonflies in the swamp, and it's going to go in there and figure out a way to get rid of the Gripplys so that it can have all the juicy dragonflies to itself. And when you're like, but the little Gripply children, it goes, oh yeah, I could have some of those too. You know, thanks for reminding me. Good looking out there. The final thing you could do is draw on spider folklore or on the behavior of other species of spiders, because there are lots and lots and lots of different types of spiders, and they all have their own different predation strategies and characteristics. You know, so for example, because they're so large and intimidating, tarantulas are often used as the evil spiders and things. But most species of tarantula aren't really that dangerous, although I think there are some exceptions. I'm not sure. Tarantulas are also associated with the idea that their bite makes people dance, the tarantella, But in fact, that spider from whom all these terms come is not a tarantula. It's a wolf spider. Don't ask me why. But so one thing you could do is just kind of do a little zoo books reading, you know, go through different species of spiders, look up, you know, 10 craziest facts about spiders articles, and just take those existing giant spiders. And this is something that Goblin's henchman sent me a link to and an article that he had done. And I'll stick a link in the show notes if I remember. But so just basically take the behavior of other kind of spiders and take one feature from that spider, maybe shooting its hairs like a tarantula does, for example. But just whatever. Take some feature from a real world spider and attach it to an existing giant spider to create a slightly different variety. A bit like how all the beetles, comma, giant, are basically the same, but then they have slightly different qualities based on what different types of beetle are like in real life. Alternatively, you could give them some powers from folklore. So for instance, you could add the thing about how, you know, they put the dancing curse on you, right? Like, they make you spin. They're spinners, after all. You could make their silk be valuable, so that, like, giant spider silk is the best thing to make climbing ropes out of, or, you know, maybe it's a desirable ultralight fabric, or I don't know, something like that. Or maybe just some wizards need it for their spell ingredients. You could definitely imagine that. That's another sort of feature that you could easily add on to the giant spider. I can't believe I didn't mention drow. Drow are associated with spiders because spiders have all the things that we already associate with drow, right? They live in caves. They like poisons, and they're real mean jerks. It makes perfect sense that the drow would worship some kind of spider goddess. It's very interesting that, you know, when you combine two animals, you always have to ask yourself whether they're more frightening combined than they were separately. So, for example, in, I want to say in the Gesta Herawardi, in one of the manuscripts about the medieval hero, Herawart the Wake, there's a story in which he fights a bear which has a human head and hands, which is a significant downgrade on a bear. A bear with just a regular bear head and hands would be much more threatening. It's a little bit like that with the drider. You know, you put the fella's upper torso in place of the head of a spider, and I don't know that it's actually more threatening, other than I guess it's got hands so it can shoot you with a bow. It's grotesque. It's horrible, but it's not threatening. But yeah, absolutely, the idea of spiders as being associated with kind of bad guy organizations and evil cults has a grand tradition in pulp imagery. There are good organizations that have spiders as their symbols. You know, one can imagine that they believe in a kind of web, so they're working together to connect things. Or there are a number of stories in which the spider represents persistence. The famous story of Robert the Bruce and the spider. And I want to say that there are similar ones in Arabic literature, but I'm not sure. So you could have kind of like heroic characters with spiders on their shields, really weirding out your PCs when they first encounter them. Like, oh, are these guys part of that weird spider cult? Oh, no. They just revere the spider for its ingenuity and, you know, it keeps away the malaria. But at heart, I think something like that only works because it forces you to think about it and set up the contrast. Because ultimately, or at least many people, are repulsed by spiders, and therefore they have become a symbol of evil, a symbol of duplicity and scheming in our culture, even though that's kind of an unfair slam on spiders. And one of the things that they can teach us is how you make a good animal monster in a D&D game, or in any fantasy game, because we're starting with an animal that we already have strong opinions about. We're starting with an animal that already has kind of deep-seated cultural meanings. Spiders mean something, and they mean something in ways that other animals do. You know, the bear means something to us, and the wolf means something to us, and even the raccoon means something to us. And when you start with one of those types of animals, then you're already halfway there in designing an animal monster, because the player's deep-seated cultural associations for those animals are doing a good deal of the work for you. Add to that just a soupçon of information about that animal's behavior and an extrapolation of what that would look like in the environment of a dungeon, and you're good to go. So I think that, you know, there's nothing, to elaborate on ways to use the spider, comma, giant is a little bit kind of gilding the lily, because it's already such a good monster, but I hope that I've suggested some ways to implement them, at least, in a way that's going to be fun. So Jake, I hope that you enjoyed your episode on an absolute fantasy classic. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Jake, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and subscribe at the $5 level. Hey, you can subscribe at any other level if you prefer. I'm not in charge. And I hope that you'll join me for future episodes of the Monster Man Holiday Boss Rush here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.